everybody, and welcome to Coach's Corner. I don't know if you read the description of this podcast, but if you did, you know you're in for a treat. And this is probably an episode that's going to resonate with a lot of you. So Dr. Sarah Gottfried is here with me to talk about her new book, The Autoimmune Cure, Healing in the Trauma and Other Triggers That Have Turned Your Body Against You. What a powerful title. And if you know me and you know this show, you know that I love to really empower people to heal on the emotional, spiritual, and mental level so that that supports their healing on the physical level. If you don't know Dr. Gottfried, she is a physician, researcher, author, and educator. She graduated from Harvard Medical School and MIT and completed residency at UCSF, but is more likely to prescribe a continuous glucose monitor and personalized nutrition plan than the latest pharmaceutical. She is a global keynote speaker and author of 4 New York Times bestselling books about hormones, nutrition, and health. Her focus is at the interface of mental and physical health, N-of-1 trial design, personalized molecular profiling, use of wearables, and how to leverage these tools to improve health outcomes. You can learn more about her at sarahgottfriedmd.com, and all her books, including The Autoimmune Cure, which came out in March, are available at Amazon and wherever books are sold. Before we dive in, I want to thank my sponsor for this week, Organifi. I am traveling right now. We are actually in beautiful California. It feels so good to be back here. California still feels like home. Officiating a wedding. Yes, we officiate weddings. Steph and I do it individually, and we actually are officiating this wedding together because it is a couple that we've coached for 2 years. And they're like, we wouldn't be getting married without you guys. So will you officiate? So we are officiating, and Athena is a flower girl, and we're all very excited. But because there have been so many events and it's just been so much fun, I've been getting even less sleep than I usually do. And while everybody is drinking their coffee, I am getting my Organifi green juice and Organifi red juice. And I want to tell you a little bit more about Organifi red juice. It's a great way to recharge your mind and body with a delicious superfood berry blend of premium organic superfoods that contain potent adaptogens, antioxidant, and a clinical dose of cordyceps. This is a way to promote energy naturally with zero caffeine and only 2 grams of sugar. And it comes in little individual packets. I just put it in my water bottle, shake it up, and I feel the difference. Whereas if I have coffee, I feel like a little bit of a surge and then I just crash and feel more tired. So Organifi Red Juice has 13 superfoods for energy, 100% USDA certified organic, and it's hard to find products where every ingredient is USDA certified organic. It tastes delicious. It helps both increase and promote energy with those natural herbs, medicinal mushrooms, and antioxidants. So you can get all of your Organifi products for 20% off if you go to Organifi.com/overit or use promo code OVERIT at checkout. That's Organifi.com/overit or use promo code OVERIT at checkout. All right, and now on to my conversation with Dr. Sarah Gottfried. Sarah, welcome to the show. I am thrilled to have you here.
Thanks, Christine. Happy to be here.
Well, I want to dive in talking about your latest book, where you really talk about autoimmunity and the connections that it has to our trauma, our past, and, you know, all the stuff that we've carried around in our emotional body for so long. And this is an area that's especially close to my heart because so many of my listeners, so many clients, so many people that come to retreats that reach out for support are dealing with some kind of autoimmune condition, often one that they don't even know what it is. It seems to be a very common diagnosis, especially among women. So I'd love to start with just asking you, what made you so passionate about writing about this particular thing and connection?
It's similar to what you're seeing in your followers, your tribe. I had so many people coming to me with issues, you know, mysterious symptoms that no one seemed to have the answers for. They would come to me as a last resort, and I would run an autoimmune panel, and more likely than not, I would see that they were making antibodies. They were attacking their own normal tissues. So I saw it in my practice. I saw an exponential rise in it over the past 10 years. I've been in practice for 30 years. And then I also found it in myself. So about 6 years ago, I tested this autoimmune panel on myself, and I had anti-nuclear antibodies, antibodies against the nucleus of my cells, and not just a little bit, but a lot. And when I started to look at the rate of having these autoantibodies, it's really dramatically increased since the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And there's one population, I was talking to my friend Mark Hyman about this, and he's got this lab that he runs. He's had 100,000 people, mostly healthy, look at their autoantibodies, and 30% of them have anti-nuclear antibodies. So it's a really common problem.
How do you test for that? Blood, or how do you test for that?
Yeah, so it's a simple blood test. You look for anti-nuclear antibodies. I also look for antibodies against the thyroid, because 15% of us have that. You can also look at rheumatoid factor. You can look at a complete blood cell count. And then you can look at measures of inflammation, like high sensitivity C-reactive protein. But your point is...
I've definitely done the C-reactive and the thyroid, but these are the anti... nuclear, I've never heard of that. Is that, has that a term been around for a while, or is that something that doctors are newly starting to look at?
It's been around a while. I would say that most doctors are not testing it unless you've got a particular constellation of symptoms. Mm-hmm. You know, things like joint pain or fatigue that's, you know, beyond kind of the usual. But what I would say is, I think all of us should be running these panels, because you can have pre-autoimmune disease for 7 to 14 years before you actually get a diagnosis. And this is one of those places, Christine, where I feel like we're failed by the conventional medical system.
Yes.
Because you might have mysterious symptoms. You might be, you know, excessively tired and you don't know why. You go to your doctor and often you're just told, oh, you just had a baby. Oh, you're just in perimenopause. Oh, you're getting older. And run the test, like see if there's something going on in the bloodstream that could explain these symptoms.
Do you mind going through this? So if people want to, people do have access to a functional medicine doctor and they want to say, hey, I want to test these things. Do you mind saying them again?
Of course. And, you know, I want to say that, yes, trauma and toxic stress is often stored in the emotional body, but it spills over into the physical body. So how do you measure?
And we're gonna definitely unpack that.
Sure. So here's the panel. This is kind of a basic panel that I run on everyone. I look at high sensitivity C-reactive protein. I do a complete blood count with a differential, CBC with a diff. I look at anti-nuclear antibodies. I look at anti-thyroglobulin antibodies and thyroid peroxidase antibodies. Those two indicate Hashimoto's thyroiditis. And then I run a rheumatoid factor. I look for celiac. So we can talk a little bit about the antibodies associated with that. But that's a basic panel. There's a more advanced panel, but that's where I start.
That's a good start, and something that doctors don't test, a lot of doctors don't test. Even when you go in, they'll test thyroid, but they won't do a full thyroid panel. So you could be regular on some thyroid measures, but not others. So I'm just so happy to have people like you on the show that are really giving us the whole picture. So let's dive into the conversation about, you know, I love the book title, The Body Keeps the Score, because it's just so pertinent to, you know, what we're going to be diving into in terms of what, you know, unprocessed trauma. And I'd love, as we dive into this, for you to explain your definition of trauma, how unprocessed trauma, or just, you know, trauma, we didn't have to add the label unprocessed, how that gets stored in the body, how that impacts our emotional body and even our mental health, and then how that can lead to physical results. So maybe start with, how would you define trauma?
Trauma is an overwhelming, distressing experience that you've had. And I think we're living in a time where trauma is used a lot more than it has been in the past, which I think is a good thing, but people have also become more inured to it. And the truth is, so many of us have experienced trauma at this point in our culture. I really like Gabor Mate's work and how he talks about trauma, not as the event itself, but the way that it lives on in your body. And what we know is that when you look at a traumatic experience, women and men tend to respond differently. So men go into typically fight or flight. So they've got this stress response that typically involves some sort of big muscle activity, you know, running or fighting. And women tend not to do that. We tend to have more of a freeze response. We have a fawn response, kind of a people-pleasing response, especially as a result of childhood experiences, adverse childhood experiences. We can have the response of, you know, just kind of being immobilized. And that's what leads to this stuckness. And the stuckness, you know, I've been practicing yoga for almost 50 years. I learned it from my great grandmother when I was a little kid.
Oh, wow. Oh.
There's a way that when you look at the subtle energetic anatomy, when you look at the emotional body, yes, that's where this distressing and immobilized response can reside. But it affects the body in a much bigger way. And the way that I like to think of it is that this overwhelming stress response, this toxic stress, affects the PINE network. And PINE stands for your psychology, I is your immune system, N is your neurological system, and E is your endocrine system. So hopefully we'll be able to talk about the PINE network. I mean, certainly you're an expert at the psychological piece and the emotional piece. I've heard some of your podcasts where you're coaching people. I especially love the one on polarity, I have to say.
Thank you.
Love it. And, you know, when you look at the PINE network, what I feel like we're seeing right now is more dysregulation than ever before. You know, our country is so divisive. We've got a level of hormonal dysregulation, nervous system dysregulation, immune system dysregulation, psychological dysregulation that I have never witnessed in my 30 years of practicing medicine. I'm curious if you've seen that too.
Oh, massively. I feel like people are walking around way more dysregulated than they even realize. It's kind of become the norm. I think stress and busyness has been a badge of honor for a long time, but it seems like, you know, from 2020 and beyond, just what I saw with the pandemic is it really triggered and brought forward a lot of unprocessed trauma because it triggered so much uncertainty and fear in people. And if we think about childhood trauma, it's usually almost always comes with uncertainty and fear. And so anything that hadn't been looked at, that had been able to be repressed for decades or years, got harder and harder to repress because there was such heightened fear and uncertainty. And so I'm just finding that there's just a lot of dysregulation because we're not taught. I mean, I took a year of Texas history in school. I never learned how to process my emotions. You know, it's not part of the conversation in our society. I'm hoping to do my part to change that, but we just often don't have the tools. So yes, I have absolutely seen it.
Yeah, I appreciate that point. I didn't learn about trauma either when I went through my education. And you would think in medical school that we would be talking about this dysregulation and how to help people with it. But instead, most of conventional medicine is really centered around acute crises, you know, like you broke an arm or you've got pneumonia, and not around how to deal with some of these chronic issues that relate to, as you describe, this level of uncertainty, fear, and often in the context of isolation. You know, we know that when trauma occurs in a community and people are able to support each other and tend and befriend, that makes a difference in terms of the ongoing results or sequela of that trauma. But when it happens in isolation, such as it did during the pandemic, yes, or, you know, for women who are really isolated, it really takes its toll.
It really does. Because, you know, one of the things that we can speak to about that is, at least from my perspective, we're not actually living in harmony. And what I mean by that is we're not living in harmony with the earth. We're not living in harmony with each other, both the divisiveness and also like we don't have real tribe and community. You know, we're not living in a village where people work together and help each other. I don't think we're meant to have these nuclear families and do so much alone. And I think that sense of the community and that interdependence and that interpersonal connection and that connection also to nature and the earth and the cycles of the seasons and all of that, we're just very disconnected. We're more connected, you know, in terms of Wi-Fi and all those things, but we're really disconnected. And I feel like that takes a huge toll on our health. I'd love to hear how you've seen that show up in patients and people that you've worked with.
It certainly has. I feel like you're tapping into something that's so critical. You know, this way of being attuned to natural cycles. You know, we use artificial light at night, and so we're not as cued into the light dark cycles. We use our laptops and phones until, you know, 10 or 11 p.m. until we go to bed, and that disrupts the melatonin signal. And that's just really the tip of the iceberg. So yeah, you know, when I had a couple of kids, my kids are now older, but when I had kids, I really felt this. I really felt this isolation after giving birth. And the thing about being postpartum is that it's a preview of coming attractions in perimenopause. It is a massive hormonal shift. And when you get that low level of hormones together with isolation, social isolation, it can really feel lonely, and it can feel like you are missing that interdependence, that sense of a village that has your back. Women especially need that. I mean, men need it too. They need it in a different way, usually around activity. But women really need that. We need to be able to talk to each other. We need that girlfriend medicine. We need to tend and befriend. You know, we know that fight is something that men do really well. Women really need tend and befriend to have a better stress response. So I see this all the time. I see, you know, the rising rate of polycystic ovary syndrome where you're not having a regular menstrual cycle. I see chronic stress hormone problems like with cortisol, you know, women who are too high during the day and they just feel super wired and revved up, or women and men who are high and low during the day, and you can have those within the same day. You can have low cortisol, which is more of a long-term problem. That's what we typically see in people with significant trauma and post-traumatic stress disorder. You can see gut issues, increased leaky gut, which I talk a lot about in the book. That's one of the precursors for developing autoimmune disease. And I see immune system dysregulation. So a lot of my patients use wearables, and one of the ways I track nervous system dysregulation, because so many of us, as you said, are dysregulated but don't know it. And so sometimes a wearable can be really helpful in that regard. So I use, for instance, heart rate variability to see what's going on with my clients and patients.
What wearables do you like for that?
I would say whatever you prefer to wear. So I love the Aura. I think the Aura data is really accurate. There's something about the ring that goes directly to your heart and the energy field of your heart that creates accuracy both with sleep and with heart rate variability, and also tracking daytime stress. I like the Whoop. I have a lot of athletes who use Whoop and use the strain level, and I think the Apple Watch has a time and a place, although I don't find it's as accurate as the Aura. I also use a lot of continuous glucose monitoring. People don't connect unprocessed trauma and toxic stress to their glucose, but they should, because food is not the only thing that causes your glucose to be dysregulated. Trauma definitely does it too.
So it, not even just trauma that you experienced, like in this moment, that's going to affect your glucose. Trauma from 30 years ago could have, you know, set your whole endocrine system off and your glucose levels could have been off for years.
Correct. So we know from all the studies that have been done on adverse childhood experiences, also known as ACEs, that if you've got elevated adverse childhood experiences like I do, it's associated with a much greater risk of metabolic dysfunction. So problems with your insulin and with your glucose, with the level of inflammation that you have in your body, which is also worsened by insulin resistance when your cells become numb to insulin. And it increases your risk of prediabetes and diabetes. So a lot of people don't put those pieces together. This is where I think it's so important to be talking, you know, for you and I to be talking about coaching and mental health, but also how this spills over into physical health.
Oh, yeah. I think, you know, so many things physically have an emotional connection. I want to bookmark PCOS because I know that's a big thing that so many women deal with. And I was talking to my mom the other day and I'm like, did your generation struggle with this? Do you remember? And she said, I remember a lot of endometriosis, but don't remember PCOS. So actually, rather than bookmark it, let's just dive into it right now. What do you see as the link, you know, the correlation, you know, between the type of trauma or the way someone has or has not handled their emotions and how that may correlate to PCOS?
It's a great question. I wrote about this in my first book, The Hormone Cure. And I was recently on Andrew Huberman's podcast where he was asking about whether I thought that patriarchy and kind of the push for women to be more masculine relates to the increased incidence that we're seeing of polycystic ovary syndrome. Mm-hmm. And we don't have direct evidence showing that there's a link, but I can tell you that women with PCOS tend to have a different type of stress response. They've got a more heightened, exaggerated stress response. I haven't seen data on adverse childhood experiences in PCOS, although it might exist. And we just know that depending on kind of the way you grew up, what you witnessed, what you accepted as being true, I think that can leave a large imprint on your hormonal orchestra. Mm-hmm. And so here's where I'm talking more about opinion. But, you know, the kind of pattern we see with PCOS, where testosterone is high, and that's therefore Andrew's question about masculinity in women. We also see estrogen dominance, so not enough progesterone. Progesterone is kind of like nature's Xanax. It's a way we soothe ourselves. And, you know, the low progesterone, higher estrogen levels, although sometimes estrogen can be normal in PCOS. And then women typically aren't ovulating. So that's one of the hallmarks of PCOS. And it makes sense because, you know, the key thing that makes women not ovulate when they're of reproductive age is not feeling safe.
Right.
So if you don't feel safe in your culture, if you don't feel safe in your body, it makes sense to me that you're not going to ovulate and you're going to have perhaps this more masculine approach to living your life.
Yeah. Well, I'll share a personal anecdote, and some of my listeners may have heard this before. I really was one of those women, especially in my late 20s and early 30s, that was more in my quote unquote masculine. What I've learned is that it wasn't necessarily my masculine. I was in a protective adaptive strategy that looked masculine. And especially my first career was in Hollywood. I was an agent and I was definitely in a male dominated profession. And, you know, women have gone, okay, great. We can go out, we can be anything, we can do anything, but there haven't been a lot of role models about how to really like be a woman and be feminine and still do things that traditionally men did, especially professionally. So I was in that world and in that culture and stressed and, again, that protective strategy of like low self-worth and not feeling accepted or wanted by men. So just let me prove and prove and prove. And that meant working a lot. And I stopped menstruating at 30, like did not have a period. So obviously I was not ovulating, never had PCOS, but finally in my mid to late 30s was like, I really need to one, heal my unprocessed trauma, and two, like actually retap into my femininity. Like I need to take off this protective mask. I need to get out of this drive, push behavior. And it wasn't an overnight thing. And people might say, what book did you read or what course did you take? And it wasn't like a one-time thing. It was a process of working through the trauma, feeling safe in my body, feeling safe to be a woman, being happy being female, feeling empowered about that. And it was just emotional work. I wasn't doing a lot of supplements or hormones except for detox. I was detoxing. And on my 40th birthday, I woke up with my period.
Well, that's beautiful.
10 years, you know, and then got pregnant naturally a few years later. And so I'm just sharing this because I really want to underline what you're saying here. And for the women that may be going now into self-judgment, like it's my fault I'm having this, whether it's PCOS or endometriosis or an autoimmune, like I should have processed my trauma. I should stop being my masculine, you know, because we tend to start blaming ourselves when we hear things like this.
Yes.
What would you say to those women?
I would say, my darling, let's figure this out together. It's not your fault. It's not a moral failing. It's probably something that you've witnessed. What you just described, Christine, is such a universal experience. Mm-hmm. You know, that feeling of being more in your masculine as a protective strategy, achieving, just to, you know, try to get the kind of attention that you deserved. And it's a strategy that, you know, some people develop in their 20s and 30s, but a lot of us developed it as kids.
Yeah. Because, oh, I developed it as a kid for sure.
Right?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
Especially young girls and women who don't feel safe at home. They're surrounded by volatility. Maybe they've got, you know, a bare minimum father. There's a way that not feeling safe at home leads to sacrificing authenticity, sacrificing femininity, and achieving as a way of getting the attention that you deserve as a kid. And so, you know, that tends to persist until you bring it into conscious healing like you did that led to your period at age 40. That's amazing that it happened on your birthday. So I feel like this is such a common theme that I see. And, you know, I'm a scientist, so I'm always looking for the evidence of this, but certainly on a somatic level, on an emotional level, all of this makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm a spiritual psychologist and I don't have lots of like quantitative data, but after doing this 20 years, like everything that you wrote about, well, in all your books, and especially this book, like, I'm just like, yes, yes, yes. This is what I've seen over and over and over and over again. And I see so many people spending so much money on supplements and, you know, all these things and not dealing with the emotional level, one, because it can feel scary, and two, because they just may not know how. So as we go through PINE and we start at that like psychological, emotional level, what would be some like first steps people could take, or what do you see as sort of like the most important work to start doing on that level?
Yeah, I appreciate talking through PINE and how to address this. And I think your point about, you know, why aren't the supplements working? Why aren't all the biohacking approaches helping reach an optimal state? It's a really good question. I feel like the kind of things that we were advised to do, you know, the cold plunges, the morning light before 8 a.m., like a lot of the biohacking strategies may or may not be effective for women.
Right.
When it comes to PINE and the psychological piece, this is where I feel like embodiment, somatic-based processes, trauma-informed care, not the standard issue talk therapy, and certainly not the standard issue selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors or one of the newer cousins, I don't find those to be very effective. You know, what I talk about in the book is that when you look at talk therapy, when you look at the three FDA-approved medications for post-traumatic stress disorder, which are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, the efficacy is like 30%. Mm-hmm. So from a psychological perspective, we need a different approach. And one of the things that Bessel van der Kolk talks about that I agree with is that the part of the brain that understands what happens to you or what happened to you, trauma, is different than the part of the brain where the trauma is lodged. And so understanding and kind of reinforcing your traumatic memory does not necessarily help. And I think that's why the efficacy is so low. It's why 30% find relief and 70% of us do not. And that was my experience. I started weekly talk therapy in my 20s when I had an episode of depression, and it didn't work. The other thing that this sets us up for, besides embodiment practices, and I'm sure you've got a lot of techniques that you use, and I can feel the somatic through line of the work that you do on your podcast. Mm-hmm. Your podcast is regulating, and I know that you are very intentional about that.
Thank you.
What we know is that somatic-based approaches like somatic experiencing, Hakomi, neuroemotional technique, those are very effective. I've found them very effective. And yet, you know, when you think about that young woman that you were in your late 20s and 30s, when you were an agent and you were in this protective strategy, you know, there's a way that when I was doing those things, Christine, I was functionally dissociated. I was totally in a cognitive, hypercognitive approach to my life. And if you ask me, Sarah, what are you feeling in your heart right now? Like, what's going on in your abdomen? I couldn't tell you. Like, I was dissociated, not, you know, multiple personality disorder or, but dissociated in a way that is really lauded in our culture.
Yep. And one of the most effective coping strategies for trauma as a child. It's like, we just, our nervous system and our body endures such trauma. And honestly, I think sometimes the only way we survive is to dissociate. So it becomes this strategy that works so well, just like being attached to achievement works so well on the goal line of life.
It does until it doesn't, right?
Exactly.
And then it can lead to, you know, being in a toxic work culture and feeling stuck there. It can lead to conflict in your relationships. It can cause you to not be a clean mirror in your parenting. And so, yeah, dissociation is something that's especially lauded in medicine, you know, to not need to sleep, to not need to feel the need to go to the bathroom or to go get food, you know, to just focus on churning through the work as fast as possible. It's also part of the culture of startups in Silicon Valley, and yet it's really no way to live. And so coming downstairs, which is kind of the way I think of it. I think of upstairs being in your mind, being cognitive. So coming downstairs and creating some integration and wholeness is critical. And that's where, you know, one of the strategies I talk about in the book is healing states of consciousness, which you can get to with breath work and with yoga and with particular ways of detoxing and fasting. And probably the greatest accelerator is psychedelic medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I know you have a chapter in your book, Everything You Want to Know About Psychedelics, which could is a whole nother podcast in itself.
Okay.
Because I do want to get to the INE, but do you want to speak to, because one thing that I love to talk about on this podcast is that, you know, going and doing quote unquote a journey with your friends or somebody who calls themselves a shaman, without doing any trauma work beforehand, without having an integration plan, without being with a really skilled person, can be really, really dangerous and not helpful. And doing it in quote unquote a more supportive way, a right way, if we can even use that word, can be very helpful. So can you, from your perspective, share, like, if we are going to use psychedelics as a way to assist us in our healing, what's really important to make sure we have in place?
Totally agree that we're not talking about recreational use. We're not talking about casual use. I really believe that if you want to resolve trauma, if you want to address the way that toxic stress lives on in your pine network, It has to be under therapeutic conditions. So I say that as someone who's finished triple certification in psychedelic medicine. So I would say that a lot of people focus on, okay, what medicine do I want to take? Do I want to do MDMA assisted therapy? Do I want to do ketamine? Do I want to do psilocybin, LSD? They tend to focus on the medication itself. And as you described, you've got to do the trauma work. You've got to understand your window of tolerance.
Yeah.
And you need to have a skilled therapist who's working with you on this. And the, you know, starting off with an intake, going through preparation, then having the journey itself where you're developing a relationship with one of these medicines. And then the most important, in my mind, is the integration. Because the integration is where you take those transmissions, you take those mystical states, and you translate them into a different way of being in the world. It's the greatest opportunity for behavior change. And it's certainly where I see people resolving their trauma.
Yeah. Well, a big one for me was ketamine. I did, I don't know, 5 or 6 IV sessions. And this was before I got pregnant, followed by NAD. It was intense. And one of the most profound experiences I had was like dropping my ego. Like it was an ego death experience and all the kind of trauma that was attached to thinking about who I needed to be in order to get love and safety and all those things in order to be liked. And it was like my whole identity. And I felt how relieving it felt not to be Christine Hassler, not from like a public brand, but just like how not to be like, it was like an ego death. The only problem with that is I've lost most of my ambition and drive to kind of just do what I love. And I don't have that same, you know, push that really like got me, you know, to where I am now, but I don't even care. It's totally fine because now I know that when I choose to do something, I'm doing it because it's really coming from an authentic place, an inspired place, and not a, I'm doing this because I feel incomplete or insecure in some way. I'm pushing myself because I think I'm not doing enough. And that was incredibly profound for me, among other things. So if someone is curious about this, and I know you probably talk about this in the book, but if someone is curious about pursuing it, what would be a good place to start, you know, as they research and what should they look for in practitioners or clinics?
Well, first, let me honor you for the vulnerability of talking about ego death. I think it's, in my mind, that's the most critical reason to have a trusted companion through this process, because going through an ego death on your own is pretty rough. Yeah. And it also, you know, what you're describing about having less ambition, maybe, you know, less of that more immature masculine drive, it leads to a cultural leadership that I think is so much more authentic and so much cleaner and really what we most need in the world right now. So you asked about how do we find these practitioners? And it's a curious time. We're on the cusp of a revolution. There are thousands and thousands of people that have been trained to provide that companionship through psychedelic journeys by MAPS and other organizations like Integrative Psychiatry Institute. So we're waiting for the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration in the U.S., to approve the use of MDMA for trauma, for post-traumatic stress disorder. And until that happens, MDMA is considered a breakthrough treatment, so you can only use it in research protocols. The good news there is that there's a lot of research protocols. So it used to be that only Johns Hopkins and NYU had psychedelic programs. Now there's so many other places. There's UCSF, UCLA, there's, you know, many university centers where you can do some of these psychedelic assisted therapy projects and try it for yourself. So that's above ground. That's what I generally recommend. The only other treatment that can act as a psychedelic, it's not a classic psychedelic because it acts by different mechanisms, is ketamine. And I live in Northern California where we've got a ketamine clinic on every street corner. And it sounds like you've got experience with ketamine. And it's a really versatile medication that can, you know, it's proven to help with treatment-resistant depression. I use it in my coaching clients to help with stuckness and with visioning. It's really versatile. So finding a ketamine practitioner, I would say, is easier than finding a research study for instance, MDMA-assisted therapy. So maybe start with ketamine and find someone who's certified in it, who's got some mental health training, someone that you really vibe with, who understands your values and your goals and can really hold space for you in a way that feels clean and safe.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for that. I know we don't have much time left, so I don't want to cheat you on going through the INE, but would you be able to touch on the immune, the neurological, and the, oh, don't tell me, what was the E? Oh,
endocrine.
Oh my gosh, said it earlier. And being up since 3:30, my brain isn't firing on all cylinders. So maybe we can start with the I.
Sure. So the immune system, the thing about it, the immune system is that 70% of it is in your gut. So this is where gut health is so critical. Most people, you know, there's a three-legged stool that you have to have to develop autoimmunity. And that is genetic predisposition, leaky gut, or increased intestinal permeability. And then the third thing is the trigger. And that trigger could be being postpartum, could be perimenopause, it could be trauma, toxic stress. So when you think about those three parts of the stool, the triad, two of them you can do something about. So you can work on leaky gut. The way that you do that with your immune system is an elimination diet. There's also some supplements, but I don't believe in supplements in isolation. I think you have to do all of this at once, things like L-glutamine, vitamin D. And then for the neurological system, this is where you have to find your menu of the things that really regulate you. So for me, you know, I've practiced meditation all of my life. Yoga and meditation are really something I have to do every day, but they weren't enough to resolve my trauma. I really needed psychedelic-assisted therapy to make a difference with my trauma. But I track my heart rate variability. I look at it every day. And there are certain things that raise it and certain things that lower it. So alcohol lowers it very consistently. So I don't drink anymore. You know, it's very rare. And then I know magnesium at night, orgasm, meditation, ketamine, other psychedelics, all of those raise my heart rate variability. So you've got to find what works for you. I just spent a weekend where I was mostly with my girlfriends and my HRV was off the chart. You know, walking in nature, hiking in nature, getting exercise, being with people.
Off the chart in a great way. You mean?
Off the chart, good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And then E for your hormones. You know, the thing about hormones is to track your pine system. Look at your cortisol. You know, do a 4-point or a 5-point cortisol during the day to see where you are. And a lot of the same things that regulate your nervous system are also going to help you regulate your cortisol. But hormonally, we're talking not just about cortisol, of course, we're talking about estrogen, progesterone, testosterone, DHEA, insulin. So that's a longer conversation, but that's, you know, in the book, I've got a protocol for addressing the pine network so that you can, you know, ideally reverse autoimmunity and potentially cure it.
Okay. So in the few minutes I have left for you, if you can answer this question. One of the things I hear people say so often is autoimmune disorders is the body attacking itself. I hear that from a lot of people. Can you speak to whether or not that statement has truth to it?
That feels like a masculine description.
Doesn't it?
Yes. So the way I would frame it, because I'm a woman and I really believe in collaboration, I would say the immune system becomes confused. So the immune system is designed to protect you. It's designed to look for pathogens for viruses and bacteria and to keep those from hurting you. And what happens in the process of autoimmunity as a result of genetic predisposition, leaky gut, plus a trigger, is that this confusion sets in. And so, yes, you end up developing a civil war where your immune system is attacking your thyroid in Hashimoto's or Graves' disease. It's attacking your joints and rheumatoid arthritis or your myelin and multiple sclerosis. But it's a state of confusion. It's a state of dysregulation. And that's where the solution lies. So the more that we can create regulation, the more that we can create homeostasis, which is where you've got that sense of inner balance and equanimity, regardless of what's happening externally, that's really what we want in terms of both defining and also solving autoimmunity.
Yeah, and on all the levels, not just the physical, down on the pine levels, all of those. And, you know, if I were to add a S at the end, I might include the spiritual level as well. I'm sure that is a part of it.
Yes, it is, for sure. It's better than all of this.
Well, this has been awesome. I'd love to have you back on the show in the future because there's so many more questions I want to ask you. Everyone, I would love for you to go and get the autoimmune cure, healing the trauma and other triggers that have turned your body against you. This is your fourth book. Is that right?
This is book six.
Book six. So I was way off. Oh my gosh. Well, Dr. Gottfried has lots of other books. The Hormone Cure is one of my personal favorites. If people want to connect with you more, I imagine they can go to your website.
Yes, the website's sarahgottfriedmd.com. And I'm also on Instagram, same handle, sarahgottfriedmd.
Awesome. Well, thank you. Thank you for your work. Thank you for, you know, really being a pioneer, because I feel like so many, you know, Westernly trained MDs that are really like opening the book and looking at the whole person are truly generational pattern breakers and trailblazers and are, you know, changing the way that we see our bodies and take care of ourselves. So thank you so much for the work personally you've done and for the work that you share with all of us.
Thank you, Christine. Same back to you. I love your work in the world. We need you desperately.
Likewise. Thank you.